it's Diane. On my mind, how Americans choose their president. Today marks the last day of voting in an election that both sides have called one of the most important in American history. Much remains unknown about what the coming days and weeks will bring, but the polls seem to indicate that Joe Biden could receive more votes than Donald Trump. Whether those votes translate into a Biden presidency is another question, one that will only be answered by what happens in the Electoral College. Jesse Wegman is a member of the editorial board at the New York Times and author of the book, Let the People Pick the President. He joined me to talk about why the founders settled on the Electoral College system and why he believes this way of selecting the president should be amended. Jesse, take me back to my 10th grade high school government class and tell me why the Electoral College actually exists.
Sure. Well, the framers of the Constitution had a lot of trouble trying to figure out how to elect the president of a self-governing republic. They had never done it before. No one had done it on this scale. And, you know, they had a lot of concerns. One of them was making sure that the president was independent. So that meant not choosing him by Congress, which would have made him, you know, beholden to Congress. It meant not having the states choose him. But then the question was, well, how are you going to do it? So, they argued for months over this. There was just endless fighting. And they didn't settle on the system that we know as the Electoral College until the final days of the convention, when a few delegates gathered in a side room and hammered the thing out, really just because they knew they needed to get the Constitution finished and sent off to the states to be ratified. They were tired, they were irritable, and they admitted after the fact that they weren't quite sure what they had been doing and they weren't quite sure how it would work. But nevertheless, they created this system we call the Electoral College. And that was to give each state a number of electors equal to their representation in Congress. That means their representation in the House and then their two senators. And the idea was to have an intermediary body of men, all men, of course, who would know more about national political candidates and be able to make a wise and considered decision among them. The founders were not, as it generally is believed, to be afraid of democracy. They were happy to have people voting directly for their members of the House of Representatives, of course, which is the most important branch in their mind of the federal government. But they thought that people wouldn't know enough about national candidates, people running for the presidency. So they created this intermediary body who would, in theory anyway, choose the president with some wisdom and political savvy.
So explain exactly how it works today.
Well, that's one of the fascinating things about the Electoral College, which is the way that it works today and what we think of as the Electoral College is actually not what the founders designed and not what they intended. So I think the two most salient features of the college as it operates today and as it has operated throughout most of American history are these. One, we the people vote for our electors directly. There's a popular vote in every state for the electors. And then those electors are awarded on a winner-take-all basis in all but two states. And that means exactly what it sounds like, that the candidate who wins the most votes in a state gets all of that state's electors. Now, both of those features are purely the result of state-based laws. They are nowhere in the Constitution. The framers said nothing about them. And in fact, when the framers saw winner-take-all rules start to be adopted in the early years of the Republic, they were horrified. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, actually proposed a constitutional amendment to ban the practice of giving electors out on a winner-take-all basis, and that's because he saw that it distorted the electorate and that it basically erased all the people in a state who didn't vote for the winning candidate.
And what happened to that proposal?
Well, it died just like every other, almost every other attempt to amend or abolish the Electoral College throughout American history. There have been 800 attempts, give or take, to amend or abolish the Electoral College throughout the country's history. And that is more by far than for any other provision of the Constitution.
Jesse, you said all but two states. What are the two states that didn't sign on to winner take all?
Well, right now, it's Maine and Nebraska. Maine and Nebraska both award their electors by a method known as the congressional district method. That means that they give one elector to the winner in each congressional district in their state, and then they give the two electors that they have for their senators to the winner of the statewide vote. So it's a twist on winner take all. And some of the framers of the Constitution thought that most states would use that method. And indeed, several states did in the early years of the Republic. Several states used winner take all. And, you know, they were experimenting all along. But they pretty much almost without exception settled on winner take all by the early 1800s. And Maine and Nebraska are just the most recent exceptions.
So most Americans didn't pay too much attention until the election of 2016. Talk about what happened then.
Sure. Well, you know, that's the crazy thing is that we've had this happen now twice in the last 20 years. In 2000, of course, you know, Al Gore, the Democratic nominee, won more than 500,000 more votes around the country than George W. Bush, the Republican. And yet he lost the election because of a few hundred votes in the state of Florida. Florida is a winner-take-all state, like almost every other state, and gave all 25 of its electors to George W. Bush, zero to Al Gore, even though they were effectively tied in the state popular vote. And then again, 16 years later, we see essentially the same thing happen. This time, it was the winner-take-all rule in three Midwestern states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And in those states, the difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton was, you know, about 77,000 votes. That's basically less than the size of a, you know, college football stadium. And, you know, 13 or 14 million people in those states cast votes. It was effectively a tie. Trump won just by a hair. And yet, because of the winner-take-all rule, he wins all 46 of those states' electoral votes. Hillary Clinton wins zero. And that is what puts him in the White House.
Jesse, tell me your own opinion of the fairness of the Electoral College approach.
Well, I can tell you my opinion, but, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, it's just liberal grousing because, you know, your candidate lost twice in the last 20 years. You know, my opinion is really that it is a fundamentally unfair system because of the way that it erases so many millions of Americans' votes and because it allows the candidate who wins fewer votes to become president. These features of our current Electoral College system violate what I consider to be two of the fundamental underlying principles of a modern representative democracy, which is political equality. That is, one person, one vote. All people are equal in an election. And majority rule, which is the person who gets the most votes wins. Now, you know, as I say, that sounds like liberal sour grapes because of Hillary Clinton and Al Gore. But in fact, you know, over American history, Americans of all political stripes have opposed the Electoral College because they've seen the harm that it causes when it targets them.
Now, take us back once again to the creation of the Electoral College and explain the role that slavery played.
Well, you know, that's a fascinating part of this story, too. Slavery and the protection of the interests of the slaveholding states in the South was at the center of every important compromise and every important deal that was struck at the Constitutional Convention, right? So, you know, the creation of the national legislature of Congress is imbued with the protection of slavery. The 3/5 clause, which applied to the House of Representatives, gave slaveholding states extra power in the national legislature for their slaves, who of course had no right to vote, had virtually no human rights at all, right? And yet those people counted to the slave states' power. And it gave slaveholding states extra power that translated into more presidencies, more speakerships of the House, more Supreme Court justices, more laws in their favor that were passed by Congress. So all of that really had a very, very concrete effect. They called it the slave power. And it played out all through the early 19th century. up until the Civil War. And, you know, the reason that it plays out in the Electoral College that way is because, as I explained earlier, the number of representatives you have in the House gets transferred over into your electoral vote. So if you have extra, you know, representatives for your slaves, you get extra electoral votes for your slaves, too. So, you know, the founders, many of the founders themselves were slaveholders and, you know, were on board with giving themselves that extra power, not just in Congress, but also in choosing the president. And we have seen throughout American history how the interests of white supremacy and of the subjugation of Black Americans has really threaded through the way that we choose our president from the very beginning until today.
So has the Electoral College ever worked the way it's supposed to?
Well, if by supposed to we mean what the framers said they thought it would do, yeah. No. you know, Alexander Hamilton has these famous lines from the Federalist Papers, which are the, you know, the propaganda that he and Jay and Madison wrote to try to sell the Constitution to skeptical New Yorkers. And he said, you know, this is going to be a body of thoughtful, deliberative men who make the best choice in the best interests of all Americans, you know, but it never actually worked that way because, you know, George Washington was unquestionably going to be the first president, no matter what method the framers chose. He wins in 1789 with a unanimous vote in the Electoral College. He wins again in 1792. And then in 1796, he decides not to run again. And by that point, there's a really important development in the country that the framers had not anticipated and not designed the Constitution for, and that is the rise of national political parties. As soon as national political parties are on the scene, the Electoral College that the framers thought they were designing stops working that way because you have instead a team sport. You have, you know, the Federalists on one side, the Democratic Republicans on the other, and you basically have them fighting for their man, not fighting for who they think in their, you know, careful estimation would be the best leader of the country, but their man, right? That started in 1796, and it is the same thing today. Electors are not thoughtful, deliberative. I mean, I'm sure they're perfectly thoughtful people, but they aren't chosen for their exceeding knowledge about politics or their education or their wisdom. They're chosen because they defend one party or the other. They are strong partisans, and that's why they vote for their candidate. They're incentivized to do so.
So when voters go to the polls, they're voting not only for the candidates, but for the electors within that state, within that jurisdiction. They may not even know who those people are.
Oh, I would say virtually never do they know who those people are. You know, every now and then there's a sort of political celebrity. This year, I think Hillary Clinton is an elector in New York. But no, 99.9% of the time, we never know the names of these people. We don't know who they are. They just happen to know somebody in state or local government or politics who, you know, has the power to select them. But I really think, you know, that's at the essence of the misunderstanding here is that, you know, yes, we are voting for technically for electors who then cast their own ballots in December for the president. But the fact that we are voting for those electors at all is not something that the framers necessarily expected, right? As I said earlier, they let states decide how to award their electors. States don't have to give us any role at all in choosing the president. State lawmakers could just keep it for themselves, and many did in the early years, right? But then by the 1820s, 1830s, all states, except for one, South Carolina, had transitioned over into a popular vote for their electors. And that was sort of part of this growing democratization of the United States, where, you know, a nation that had been founded when only, you know, propertied white men could vote was very quickly expanding its notion of who was part of the democracy that the country had created. So, you know, the fact that we vote at all, while we consider that a kind of part of our democratic heritage, it's actually not. The framers didn't expect that to happen.
So tell me about the many attempts to reform the Electoral College and what those attempts were and how and why they all failed.
Well, as I said, there have been 800 or so attempts to amend or abolish the college. It's far more than for any other provision of the Constitution. They started in 1797. They haven't let up. They're still being introduced in Congress today. They've come from all ends of the political spectrum. And, you know, some of them have just tried to tweak the system to either require a certain method of states awarding their electors. But increasingly, it has just been to abolish the college outright and replace it with a popular vote across the country. And, you know, the story that I tell in my book that is, I think, a fascinating and really instructive one is the effort in late 1969 and 1970, which got us closer to a national popular vote in the Constitution than any in American history. This effort was launched by Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana in the mid-1960s, right after the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act had passed, and Americans were really rethinking the notion of what it meant to be a democracy and whose voices were included in it. Birch Bayh actually kind of latches on to that momentum, and by 1968, 80% of Americans were supporting a national popular vote for president. This wasn't a Democratic, you know, plot. This was Richard Nixon as president was in support of this. You know, George H.W. Bush supported it. Bob Dole supported it. These were like, top Republican leaders. And that's because it was generally understood to be a good advance in American democracy. It passed the House of Representatives, an amendment to abolish the Electoral College, passed the House of Representatives overwhelmingly in 1969, the only time in American history that's ever happened. It looked like states were ready to ratify it. It stalls in the Senate. And that's because of Southern segregationist senators who blocked it with a filibuster until it died in 1970.
Why?
Well, as I said, the history of racial subjugation, racial discrimination is threaded throughout the story of the Electoral College from the founding up until today. The Southern segregationists, who were themselves the descendants of slaveholders, they knew that their states benefited from an electoral college system in which their votes counted and their black citizens' votes didn't, right? So, you know, throughout Jim Crow in the first half of the 20th century, black voters were now technically full citizens with voting rights, and yet they were kept from the polls. They were either through poll taxes, literacy tests, or just outright terrorism and murder were kept away from the polls. So the white Southern segregationists who had the political power in the South, they knew that if you had a popular vote for president, all of those black voters would suddenly count as much as they did. And they didn't want that to happen. So they filibustered. These were the same senators, by the way, who filibustered the Civil Rights Act just a few years earlier. They lost that fight and they were still fuming about that in the late 1960s. This one they won.
Wow, that's quite a story. Talk about the fact that so many people look at the Electoral College as unfair because of the size of states and how then those states are misrepresented in the Electoral College.
I'm glad you brought that up because that is a distorting effect of the way the Electoral College is designed. And a lot of people sort of see that and they get really upset. They look at Wyoming and California and they say, wait a minute, you know, Wyoming gets 3 electoral votes and California gets 55 electoral votes, but still a Wyoming voter's vote, you know, counts 4 times as much relative to their population as one in California. And that's not fair. I agree, it isn't fair. It is the reflection of the fact that every state, you know, has 2 senators and gets 2 electors for their senators. But I think what people maybe misunderstand when they focus on that problem is that it's actually a pretty minor problem in the bigger picture. The influence of those 2 extra votes for senators is very, very small compared to the distortions caused by that winner-take-all rule. The winner-take-all rule is the fundamental distortion that gives us popular vote-losing presidents, that basically erases the votes of political minorities in every state in the country. And that is the thing I think we really need to focus on. The Senate, you know, the Senate's not going anywhere. It can't be amended. The Constitution itself basically prevents its being amended in any way. So I think as long as we have an Electoral College, the thing to focus on is that winner-take-all rule. That's the rule that really is the deepest insult to political equality in America.
Explain how that winner-take-all rule could be amended without moving to disband the entire Electoral College.
About 15 years ago, a computer scientist in Northern California with a side interest in electoral politics looked at this situation and he said, this is ridiculous. You know, this was right after 2000. Al Gore had won the popular vote but lost the presidency. And, you know, people everywhere were like, wait a minute, how does this system even work? This doesn't make sense. And so he actually designed a really clever way of using the Electoral College to get us effectively to a popular vote. And that design is what's called an interstate compact. It's an agreement among states to award their electors in a different way than they do today. Right now, all but two states award their electors based on winner-take-all in their state. And what this agreement does, this interstate compact does, is states that sign on to it say, instead of awarding our electors to the winner of our state, we will award our electors to whichever candidate gets the most votes in all 50 states and DC combined. And the agreement only kicks into effect once states representing a majority of electoral votes in the country, that's 270, that's what you need to win to become president, join the compact. So when you have 270 votes worth of states in this compact, it takes effect and automatically the candidate who wins the most votes in the country becomes the president. 15 states have joined so far, plus DC, so that you're at 196 electoral votes among all of them. That means you have 74 more votes to go before you elect the president by a direct popular vote.
So do you think that will happen in the short term? Not today, but in the coming years?
You know, right now, all the states that have joined this compact are Democratic-led states, what we call blue states, right? Now, I hate that term. I hate blue and red states because it's an artificial rendering of the country that makes it seem like nobody but Democrats live in California and nobody but Republicans live in Texas, when in fact, millions of Democrats and Republicans live everywhere, right? You know, 4.5 million people voted for Donald Trump in California alone in 2016. That's more than the population of most states in this country. And yet all of them were erased when the Electoral College voted because California uses the winner-take-all rule. So the question is, well, how do you convince everybody to see that it's in their interest, right, wherever they live, to adopt a system in which all votes count equally? In fact, Republicans all over the country have been interested in this compact as long as it's been around, and it has passed Republican-led chambers in several red, so-called red states. Unfortunately, what happened in 2016, I think, really sent everybody back into their partisan corners and made it seem like a much more partisan issue, when actually throughout American history, opposition to the Electoral College has not been a partisan issue. It has been a nonpartisan or bipartisan issue. So your question, how do we get there? I think the answer is you really have to convince the people who are currently suffering or who will soon suffer under the Electoral College to see that it's in their interest to change. And the best example I can give you on that is Texas. Texas has been really, you know, reliably a Republican state. You know, it has voted for the Republican presidential candidate for decades now, with just a couple exceptions. If Texas were to give its 38 electors to the Democratic nominee, which could happen this year, I think it's unlikely, unbalanced, but it could happen. And the fact that we're even talking about it is telling. If that were to happen, Republicans have no Electoral College path to the presidency. They depend on Texas. So if that were to happen, I think suddenly you see Republicans saying, wait a minute, this Electoral College that we thought worked for us doesn't work for us. We have no way to win power anymore. And then I think you see an openness, a willingness on the Republican side as well to change the system that we use for electing the president.
More of my conversation with Jesse Wegman when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Jesse Wegman. He is a member of the New York Times editorial board and author of Let the People Pick the President, the Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. What about the relationship between the Electoral College and policies that come from the president who is elected by that Electoral College?
I'm so glad you asked that, because that's really the most concrete harm caused by the winner-take-all law. You know, winner-take-all creates two kinds of states, safe states and battleground states, right? Safe states is where most of us live. Those are states where the margin is just, it's far enough apart between the two candidates that nothing any candidate does can make a difference to change that vote, right? They're going to give all their electors to the Democrat or all their electors to the Republican. 40 or 45 states every 4 years fall into that category. More than 80% of us live in those states. Then there are the battleground states. And those are the states that are so closely divided that a little bit of campaigning, a little bit of attention, a little bit of policy proposal can really change the outcome in that state. It can move a few hundred or a few thousand votes one way or the other, and then give the entire pot of electors in that state to one candidate or the other. So the candidates are incentivized to pay all their attention to those states. And what that results in is an overbearing focus on issues of interest to people only in those states and nowhere else in the country. Why have the candidates been talking so much about fracking, and who supports fracking and who doesn't support fracking? Because fracking largely happens in Western Pennsylvania. Western Pennsylvanians care a lot about it. They should care about it. It's an important issue to them, but it's not the only issue that should matter. We should be talking about wildfires in California or public transportation in the big cities where tens of millions of Americans live and are affected by our policies, right? But because battleground states draw all of the attention and all of the focus from the candidates of both parties and from the president, by the way, presidents actually send more money to battleground states when they're in office through federal grants than they do to non-battleground states, right? This is something that's a problem, not just during the election, but throughout the governance of the country. And this is the fundamental point, right? That the president is elected to serve all of the people everywhere, no matter where they live. He or she is the president, not of the battleground states, but of the United States.
Earlier, you talked about the efforts of Birch Bayh, but even earlier than that, tell me more about Texas Representative Ed Gossett and what he did back in 1950.
I'm so glad you brought up Ed Gossett. He's a great character in this story because he illustrates how everybody hates the winner-take-all rule and everybody has hated it as soon as they sense that it harms them. So just to set up a little bit of Ed Gossett here, remember how I told you that it was the Southern segregationists who led the filibuster to prevent the amendment from passing in 1970? Okay, they were joined by a very strange bedfellow, which was Black voters and ethnic minorities in the northern states, and particularly in New York City. Why was that? Because New York in the middle of the 20th century was the biggest and most important swing state in the country. And the way New York swung decided the outcome of the election. And the people who swung New York were Black and Jewish voters in the big cities. So they were actually on board with the segregationist effort. The NAACP and top Black political leaders also wanted to save the Electoral College because they knew it gave them extra power. Now, this power isn't earned. It's just by chance of where they happen to live. But nobody gives up power willingly, right?
Right.
So this was clear. This dynamic was clear for decades before 1969, 1970, when Birch Bayh was trying to abolish the college. Ed Gossett was a white conservative from Texas. He was a Democrat. Irrelevant, because that's the Democrats in the South in the early part of the 20th century were the conservatives, right? And he was furious that these Blacks and these Jews in the North could actually swing the entire election in favor of their preferred candidate. So I just want to, can I just read you a passage of a speech he gives on the floor of the House in 1950? And this is advocating for a change in how we award our electors. He wanted a constitutional amendment to award electors proportionally within a state. So relative to how many voters, if 60% of a state's voters voted for one candidate, that candidate got 60% of the state's electors, rather than winner take all. So here I'm just going to read you an excerpt of his speech. "Now, please understand," he said, "I have no objection to the Negro in Harlem voting and to his vote being counted, but I do resent the fact that both parties will spend 100 times as much money to get his vote, and that his vote is worth 100 times as much in the scale of national politics as is the vote of a white man in Texas. Is it fair? Is it honest? Is it democratic? Is it to the best interest of anyone, in fact, to place such a premium on a few thousand labor votes or Italian votes or Irish votes or Negro votes or Jewish votes or Polish votes or communist votes or big city machine votes simply because they happen to be located in two or three large industrial pivotal states?"
Wow.
He couldn't have better illustrated the argument against winner take all than that. And all you need to do is take out the nouns in that speech and replace them with what we're experiencing today, which is largely older white voters in the upper Midwest in places like Michigan and Wisconsin, right? And you have the same problem. And liberals are the ones who kind of see it most clearly now because they're the ones whose ox is being gored. But Ed Gossett was seeing it clearly in 1950.
Jesse, tell me about faithless electors and how big a role they may or may not have played in the history of our elections.
The short answer is very little. No faithless elector has ever affected the outcome of a presidential election, and I don't think one ever will. Just to define our terms here, a faithless elector is someone who votes for a candidate other than his or her party's nominee, the person that he or she pledged to vote for. And this kind of gets back to this, I think, functioning of the college that a lot of people still don't understand, which is electors are not just this body of neutral observers waiting to be told what to do, right? They are picked by the parties, and each party has its own slate of electors for each state. So, you know, California has 55 electoral votes. So Joe Biden has 55 people who are electors in California. They were all chosen because they want to vote for him. Donald Trump has 55 Republican electors in California. Same deal on his side. So the idea that one of these people would go faithless, in other words, would vote for someone other than the person that they had been picked to vote for, is just, it just doesn't happen. It goes against logic. It goes against the whole reason that they're there. It does happen periodically, and it happened seven times in 2016. Seven different electors were faithless. But obviously, you know, the story I tell in the introduction of my book is that several of these people were doing so in order to try to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. So it can be a strategic gambit in certain cases, but it happens so rarely in the bigger picture that it never is going to influence the outcome of an election.
So what do you see happening in the future as far as the Electoral College is concerned, and how soon?
My argument in the book is that even when the president wins the Electoral College and the popular vote, in other words, that there is not a split between those two, I think the Electoral College is causing harm to our representative democracy for the reasons I explained, which is that winner-take-all rule really incentivizes candidates of both parties to pay all of their attention to just a small number of battleground states that are just arbitrary states. They're not representative of the country in any way. In some cases, they're actually not representative of the country. What I would like to see is a presidents or candidates from both parties who are forced to pay attention to all Americans everywhere, no matter where they live and no matter how they vote. So that's really what I'm hoping we get toward. The problem is that when you have presidents who are elected by both the Electoral College and the popular vote who win both of those, people think, oh, the system is working. And that reduces the energy, I think, for reform. We're at this sort of fever pitch right now in talking about democratic reform because we've now seen twice in the last 20 years and very possibly again this year, a popular vote Electoral College split. I really hope we don't see that. You know, although I'm sure more people would want to read the book, I would be really upset to see that happen once again, because I think it's a profound violation of basic principles of representative democracy, and not even one that I think the framers really anticipated or thought about. So, I mean, my hope is that Americans of all political stripes will see the way that the Electoral College hurts them. Maybe it's Texas going to the Democrat and Texas Republicans saying, wait a minute, this is not a system we can live under anymore. And then you have both parties that are getting screwed by the Electoral College in a short window and realize this is the time for reform. I think that's the way it happens in the next decade or so. I hope that we have enough energy to make it happen. But, you know, it has been with us for 200 years, and it is a heavy lift.
Jesse, today is election day when you and I are speaking. Have you voted?
I have voted. I voted early. I filled out my ballot and went down to town hall and dropped it off. I was really happy to be able to do that and take some of the pressure off of the vote counters, who are going to have a really busy night.
Are you confident about this year's election, that it will be fair, that the vote count will be fair?
I think I have a complex answer to that question. Election administrators of both political parties, I think, are actually very people of integrity and patriotism. They care about running elections well and smoothly. They are, I think, our best last defense for a good vote and a fair vote. Nevertheless, I see, you know, all kinds of measures that have been undertaken primarily by Republicans around the country to make voting as hard as possible, if not impossible, for millions of Americans who tend to lean Democratic. And that really concerns me, the idea that a major political party is actually trying to drive down or suppress turnout all over the country is the opposite to me of what a representative democracy should be. We can disagree about policies and still agree that the more that people participate, the better and healthier our democracy is. So yes, I think it's going to be a well-run election today, and it already has been. They've already been taking in and processing tens of millions of ballots, more, I think, than we'll have seen in many decades. And yet, behind it all is this real concern about the efforts to drive down voting and voter turnout by one party in particular. So how do we cure that in the future? I don't know. I think Republicans are going to have to be defeated enough to realize that that's not the way to win, and that actually they need to craft a policy platform that appeals to a majority of Americans in order to win.
Jesse, thank you. It was good to be with you on this important day.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation.
That was Jesse Wegman, member of the New York Times editorial board and author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. If you haven't already voted on this election day, I hope you will do so. In the meantime, stay safe, be well, and be patient. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reed.